Our topic today will be the rise of Stalinism. On Thursday, the decline of Stalinism. And if you want me to give a third talk on the fall of Stalinism, I'll have to return at some future day. I hope it will not be too far from this day. On November 12, 1927, Trotsky, Zinoviev, and other opposition leaders were expelled from the Russian Communist Party by the Stalin faction. This was 10 years after Trotsky, with Lenin, had led the Petrograd Uprising, which gave power to the workers and peasants and placed the Bolsheviks at the helm of the first workers' republic in history. What happened in those 10 years, and what was the meaning of this shift in political power? There are many current explanations for the rise and triumph of Stalinism. This is one of the key questions of political history in the past half century. By far the most popular in this country is the theory which attributes Stalin's tyranny to some original sins of Bolshevism, its super-centralist organization, its amoralism, its terrorism. According to the arguments of this school, Stalin simply developed, accentuated, and consummated the essential evil features of Leninism when he took over following Lenin's death. Stalinism is supposed to be the continuation, the perfecting of Leninism. And the destruction of democracy in Russia was the inevitable result of the Marxist doctrine of the dictatorship of the proletariat, or at least the stifling of the promise of democracy held out by the revolution. Cold War Kremlinologists like Bertram D. Wolfe, an ex-leader of the right opposition in the Lovestone Group, and 1,000 Anglo-American professors, no doubt you have some of them here at Wayne, draw a straight line leading from Marx through Lenin to Stalin. The old-time Stalinists and now the Maoists do the same thing. Of course, there are differences between them. The two sides in the Cold War have opposite sets of values. The Stalinists put a plus in the connection, over the connection between Stalin and Lenin and Marx, whereas the bourgeois ideologists place a minus all the way along the line. We Marxists have an entirely different appraisal and explanation of the nature of Stalinism. For us, Stalinism is the negation, the counter-revolutionary antithesis, the destroyer of Bolshevism. It is, in its program, ideology, and practice, a revisionist, opportunist departure from scientific socialism. The Russian Communist Party of 1927, and even more of 1967, was only in form and appearance the same as the Bolshevik Party led by Lenin and Trotsky 50 years ago in October 1917. It served other social interests, had a different leadership, and was headed in the opposite direction. It was no longer the political instrument of the vanguard workers, peasants, and intellectuals, but the state machine of the newly privileged bureaucracy and upper crust of Soviet society. Nor was Stalin's one-man rule the predestined form of the rule of the working class, or if you prefer a more scientific designation, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Stalinism rather represented a terrible deformation of the workers' state, which came about as the result of specific historical circumstances inside and outside the Soviet Union. It was the political expression of a transfer of sovereignty from one set of social forces to another. There are three rules of procedure in the dialectical method of approaching any kind of historical phenomena. The first is, how did it originate? The second is, through what stages has it passed? And the third is, where is it at its present point of development? Now let's start with the first question. In our examination of Stalin's, namely its genesis, what were those circumstances that derailed the revolution and deformed its political structure? Now, this is often made very obscure and complex and mystified. But I think a rather simple analogy will help cast light upon the process and the problem. If a child is stunted, has rickets, and becomes bow-legged, this happens because he lacks the right kind of nourishment, the vital ingredients which would permit him and enable him to grow up to normal stature with agreeable features and well-proportioned organs. That's understood by all doctors and biological pathologists. The same rules of growth apply to social structures and to political regimes, and above all, to the young Soviet Republic. It became a victim of extremely disagreeable and ugly malformations because its society and state were deprived of the proper nourishment for a harmoniously evolving workers' government in its formative years. The Soviet Union was not the first and is not the only country that has been deformed in this fashion. Although you would think so to listen to the Cold Warriors, let's take our own country, for example. In the formative stages of our national development, our own bourgeois society and our American nation witnessed the revival of archaic institutions, relations, and social evils because of our economic and social backwardness. You've heard of an institution called chattel slavery. Played quite a role in the history of the United States. In fact, our country was disfigured for 300 years by the institution of black chattel slavery, an anachronistic mode of production which had already largely disappeared from Europe when it was reborn in the Americas. And it took a civil war to rid our republic of this slave power and the slave society in the southern states. And the struggle for black power demonstrates that the effects of this evil persist to this very day. But do you ever hear the academicians make any parallel between the two? Why, you'd think that the first worker state was the first time that any society had ever been slightly askew. Now, this example from our own history should warn us to take a more objective and scientific attitude toward the vicissitudes of the Russian Revolution and the stages through which it has been compelled by circumstances beyond anyone's control to go through. Now, so much for the generalizations. Now to get down to specifics. What were the deprivations from which the young Soviet Union suffered and what caused them? Let us first examine the external factors, those on the international arena, which are always decisive in the last analysis. The Russian Revolution failed to have any immediate sequel or to be successfully extended into the countries of Western Europe with their more advanced economy and culture. Lenin anticipated, as I observed yesterday, that the salvation of the Russian Revolution and its republic would rest upon a union of an agricultural Russia with an industrialized Germany. Industrial Germany was to be the locomotive that was to replace the peasant's cart. The sequence of events in the struggle after the First World War was unfavorable to this prospect. The armies of the Soviet Union, after beating back the interventionists, marched into Poland and toward Warsaw, but were beaten back. The independent Hungarian and Bavarian revolutions were crushed. And then the key company, the country, Germany, had setbacks to the workers' revolution, first in 1918, then in 1920, and finally in 1923, at the time of the great inflation and the Ruhr invasion. The anti-capitalist sentiments, movements, and actions of the European masses were strong enough at that time to shield and save the Soviet Union from the imperialist interventionists, especially during its last spasm. Some of you may have heard that when Winston Churchill got ready in 1920 to send reinforcements to the Crimea to back up the White Army, the British trade union leaders warned him that they would not support such an action. The British longshoremen refused to load ships. The British soldiers and sailors were getting ready to resist. And this stayed Churchill's hand. But all the actions and uprisings of the European workers were not strong enough to overthrow capitalism in any other place and replace it with workers' power. Now, what were the fundamental reasons for this failure? They were two, and they were linked together. The first was the policies pursued by the traditional leadership of the Workers' Party in Western Europe, which operated under the banner of the Second International. These were either right-wing social democrats or centrists, that is, wavering social democrats. And they were incapable, or they did not want to, or they actually blocked the mobilization of the masses for the revolutionary struggle for power. The second reason was a collateral one, and that was the incapacity of the revolutionary vanguard to create in time a leadership and party to displace and replace the established organization. You know, a revolutionary party that can fill the requirements is not something you can order from a Sears Roebuck catalog. It takes a long time and a lot of testing to create the cadres capable of leading the masses for revolutionary conquest of power, especially in an advanced country. And humanity has paid very dearly since that time for the failure of having time to perform that necessary work of preparation. There was no lack of valiant and even capable leaders like Karl Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, Leo Jurgutis, and others in 1918. They formed the Spartacus Bund, but they were smashed. Their leaders were murdered with the connivance of the right-wing social democrats by Junker officers. And the newly born Communist Party of Germany was unable to show the necessary capacities from 1923 and even up to 1933 to fulfill the job. As a result of these defeats and defaults, the Soviet Union became and remained for decades isolated in a capitalist world, a very precarious situation indeed. It was encircled and embargoed by imperialism, as Cuba and China are today. But at least Cuba and China had the advantage of aid from other worker states, including a powerful Soviet Union. That was not true of the USSR in the early years. After that, the initial setbacks and disappointments of 1918 to 23 in the West were extended to the East with the crushing of the Chinese Revolution in 1927. As a result, no breakthrough of the revolution either in the West or to the East. And this isolation hung like a terribly leaden weight upon the Russian Revolution and its vanguard, dragged it back and pulled it down. So much for the principal external factors. Let us now pass over to the domestic factors which held back and pushed back the progress of the revolution at its crest. First of all, there was the weariness of the Russian people. Just look at what they had to go through. 3 years of imperialist slaughter. Two revolutions in 1 year, 1917. 3 years of civil war on 21 fronts. Famine to the extent of cannibalism in some peasants. they gave everything they could. But you know, peoples and classes get tired. Because after all, you know, classes are made up of individuals. And it was that exhaustion, or rather the accumulated fatigues among millions of individuals, that gave rise to a collective exhaustion from one end of Russia to another. To this was added famine, hunger, and strict rationing of very scarce commodities under the system of war communism. On top of that, wide unemployment, stoppage of industry, unrestrained inflation. The working class of Russia was very heroic and combative, but it was small. There were no more than 5 million at the peak in a country of 160 million, the reverse of the proportion of class forces in a country like the United States, for example, where we might have 5 million farmers and the preponderance wage workers. The peasantry comprised over 90% of the population. And this peasantry was a backward one, economically and culturally. It wasn't like the Western European or the American and Canadian small farmer. It was semi-feudal, was illiterate. It was only halfway out of Asiatic barbarism and backwardness. Only semi-Europeanized or semi-capitalized. It was on this social basis that privileged bureaucrats who reflected moods of conservatism and defeatism and wanted finally to enjoy for themselves some of the fruits of all their efforts began to come forward and take over. Now, these moods and feelings in the population could not help being transmitted into the Bolshevik Party and becoming expressed in factional struggles within its leadership and its ranks, because no party is sealed off from surrounding social layers, especially a leading party, which is in contact with them all the time. But even a party which is rather small is likewise subjected to all kinds of influences from its immediate environment. Now, you can see that, for example, going on in China today, with those continuous and still unresolved conflicts at the top of the Chinese Communist Party between the Mao faction, Liu Shaoqi faction, and other tendencies. Because that's the only channel through which differences and divisions in the country can express themselves under the given political conditions in that country, and it was the same in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. And if you are slightly confused and bemused by what is happening in China today, you can well understand the psychology of people who watched similar events in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. Fortunately, we have the precedent of the Soviet experience in the 1920s to enable us to decipher a little bit better what is happening in the China of today. Now, these tendencies manifested themselves, though, in a smaller compass, even while Lenin was still alive. And in his last couple of years, he was extremely concerned about the way things were going. He issued warnings, if you will read his articles in 22 and 23, about the growing clutch of the state bureaucracy, their incapacity to be sensitive to the needs of the people. He came into direct collision with the party secretary, Stalin, over the administration of the party, and especially over the national question, because Stalin and Orji Kanidze, his lieutenant, treated very harshly the people in the Caucasus. And he asked the question. He said, we have all these people staffing and manning the state apparatus, and we have the members of the Bolshevik Party, but who is leading whom here? He says, it's not clear. We've got to find out, and if necessary, take corrective measures. And one of the measures he took was to solicit a bloc with Trotsky against these tendencies and against Stalin's secretaryship and its methods in particular. You can read about this in Isaac Deutsch's second volume of the Prophet Unarmed, Disarmed, Unarmed, I guess. Disarmed. Stalin was aware of this partnership between Lenin and Trotsky. And through his control of the apparatus, he was able to pack the 1923 convention and forfend the most drastic measures against him, which would have culminated in his removal. And in fact, when the testament of Lenin was read to the Central Committee, it expressed his apprehension and contained the suggestion that Stalin should be removed from his important office because of his rudeness and untrustworthiness. Lenin's death unleashed a struggle for succession in the leadership. Through which the different social interests and political divergences manifested themselves. Before Lenin had died, but while he was still ill and paralyzed, a bloc had been formed by the three old Bolshevik leaders, Zinoviev, Kamenev, and Stalin, against Trotsky. It was an unprincipled combination called the Troika, which is a three-wheeled vehicle. Its aims were primarily organizational. It was first, don't do anything to rock the boat, either at home or abroad. Take it slow. And second, surround and isolate Trotsky. And in order to conduct this struggle for organizational primacy, the three men invented the legend of Trotskyism as something different from and opposed to Leninism. And that is where the original counterposition of the two originated. Trotsky was accused falsely of advocating adventurism, of having been an anti-Bolshevik and retaining traces of it, of being too proud, too uncooperative, of ignoring the peasant, and above all, as creator and head of the Red Army, of thinking about being a Bonaparte, seizing the state power by utilizing his position at the head of the Red Army. There was underneath certain whispers of anti-Semitism as well. Now, in the polemics of that time, which were rather one-sided, there was a concerted campaign against Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution. And because this theory indissolubly tied up the progress and prosperity of the revolution within Russia with that of the international struggle against capitalism, it became more and more distasteful to the more nationally limited leaders within the Communist Party. And later in 1924, Stalin came forward with a new theory which he concocted ad hoc to suit the needs of the organizational struggle. And that is, of course, the theory of building socialism with one country, that country being the Soviet Union. Now, at the beginning, and from the very beginning, this constituted a break not only with the very principles of Marxism and the traditions of Bolshevism, but with the spirit of internationalism. This was not clear to many people because the rhetoric of internationalism was maintained. It only came clear in practice. It also meant the introduction of the Menshevik theory of relying not upon the independent organization and action of the workers and peasants and their communist leadership, but a search for progressive, liberal, peace-loving, anti-imperialist elements outside of the plebeian ranks. And some of the prime candidates chosen by Stalin were Chiang Kai-shek, who was made an honorary member of the Presidium of the Third International, believe it or not, and the reformist leaders of the British trade unions and some others of lesser importance in smaller countries who probably would not mean much to you today. Now, Trotsky saw what was at issue much sooner, and I would say not only Trotsky, but his immediate associates, much sooner than most others, primarily because he was in a better vantage point for observation, being one of the leaders of the party, the army, and other departments. And in 1923, he wrote a series of articles on the diminution of party democracy and the dangers involved, and calling for reforms in the situation, which were later published in a book called The New Course. We may say that that is the first war cry of the left opposition. The left opposition was constituted by almost 60 very prominent leaders of the party and of the Republic. It published a platform in 1923. The main issues were the following. First, the enhancement and reinforcement of democracy in the party and putting bridles upon the unbridled bureaucrats. The second was the defense of an international policy of revolutionary struggle as against exclusive practical focus upon domestic problems. But it did not ignore the very pressing domestic problems. It expressed concern about the growing strength of the rich peasants, the kulaks, under the new economic policy in which the revival of trade and the petty accumulation of wealth had introduced widespread inequalities. And as countermeasures, it advocated an industrial plan for the first time in Soviet history, and measures leading towards cooperation and eventual collectivization in the peasant economy. The first collision over foreign policy between Stalin and Trotsky took place in regard to Germany in 1923. Germany was plunged into a social and political crisis at that time because of the raging inflation and the French invasion of the Ruhr and the Rhineland. A revolutionary opportunity presented itself. Trotsky and others felt it was necessary to take the necessary preparations and steps in order to proceed toward the conquest of power, but the advice of Stalin was to hold back. The revolutionary opportunity was missed, and another one did not come until the crash of 1929. At that time, Trotsky was no longer in the Soviet Union. Stalin had total power, and his disastrous policies were then responsible for the triumph of Hitlerism. When Zinoviev and Kamenev, who had been among the most trusted and close associates of Lenin, saw the way things were going, they had second thoughts. They broke with Stalin and with Bukharin, who represented the right wing in the Russian Communist Party, and came over to Trotsky and proposed a joint struggle against the center and the right, that is, the Stalin-Bukharin bloc. And so in 1925, there was constituted the united opposition of the Trotskyists, the left opposition, and the Zinoviev Kamenev group, which led the party in the principal centers of Leningrad and Moscow. Nevertheless, Stalin kept concentrating more and more power in his hands, both in the state, the party, and the Communist International. And from 25 to 27, the policies his faction imposed led to disastrous debacles. One, in the West, where the Russian trade unions and the British trade unions were coupled together under the supervision of a bloc between the Soviet communists and the British trade union leaders. It was a time when Great Britain was heading toward the general strike. And when that general strike came, the Communist Party and the people under its influence were shackled by this bloc, which Stalin refused to break, even although Trotsky and the others demanded that it had to be broken in order to free the revolutionary elements in England to combat the betrayal which was in process under the existing English trade union leadership. However, this bloc was broken, but upon the initiative of the British trade union leaders, when they just had squeezed it dry and had no further use for it after the general strike had been broken by the Churchill government. An even more tragic event took place in China from 1925 to 1927, when hopes were pinned upon the United Front with Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang on the ground that a bloc of four classes was necessary: the anti-imperialist bourgeoisie, the peasants, the intellectuals, and the workers. And those of you who know anything about Chinese history are familiar with the two massacres, one in Shanghai and the other in Canton, which pulverized the young Chinese Communist Party and strangled the Second Chinese Revolution, a development from which it did not recover for 20 years or so. During this time and thereafter, the Communist International, and especially its leadership, were thoroughly purged of all independent and critical-minded leaders and became a docile tool of the foreign policy of the Soviet bureaucracy. I have itemized the major developments that marked the road toward the bureaucratization of the Soviet Union, the decline of the Russian Revolution, and the backsliding of its Communist Party. Now, how was one to explain why this happened? You must remember that this was an absolutely unprecedented problem. There had never been a workers' state before. That was difficult enough as a fact. But certainly no one had predicted that once such a state came into being, it would undergo very severe degeneration, because the founders of Marxism had assumed that the capitalists would be overthrown in highly industrialized countries, whereas in actuality, the workers first came to power in backward Russia. There were two wrong analyses and answers given at that time. The first was very sedative. It was that of the official Communist Party. They said Stalin is the head of the Soviet Union. He's all wise as well as all powerful. He knows what he's doing, even if we're a little puzzled by it. We have total confidence in him. And anybody who even whispers a doubt or raises a question is either a revisionist, a Trotskyist, a counter-revolutionary, or an agent of the capitalist class. And you see a repetition of this, although not quite so vociferously, because after all, the world has passed through the Stalinist experience in relation to Mao Zedong in China. There are many people, although not so many as those who inclined before Stalin, who say, well, after all, didn't Mao lead a revolution? Hasn't he been at the head of the People's Republic of China for 17 years? Isn't his wisdom irrefutable? And who are we, after all, to question a person like that? Now that was the sedative answer, but there was one that went to the opposite extreme. And this was that because there was black backsliding in the Soviet Union, everything was lost beyond repair and redemption, the Soviet Union had reverted to the status of a class society or capitalism or whatever they chose to label it, and it was necessary to begin all over again from the beginning. Now the analysis of the left opposition, especially as formulated in Trotsky's writings, avoided both of these extremes. It was a dialectical analysis. His first answer was given in theses on revolution and counter-revolution, which were written in 1926 but not published. It became the basis for his subsequent position. You can find them in the anthology on the Age of Permanent Revolution. This position was presented in detail in his classic work, The Revolution Betrayed, and I won't give you a digest of what is contained in it. I'll only strongly urge you to read and study. But the left opposition did not content itself with examining and analyzing what happened according to the methods of Marxism. It was, after all, a political faction, and it was duty-bound, as it did, to propose alternative proposals, paths of action, and programs at every stage of the Stalinist degeneration in the Soviet Union. What then, in conclusion, is Stalinism, and how should it be defined? in its origins, Stalinism represents the bureaucratic reaction to the Russian Revolution, caused by the defeat of the world revolution, the isolation of the first worker state, the economic and cultural backwardness of the Soviet Union, and the political passivity of the Soviet masses. Second, it's the movement, the rule, the practices, the ideology of a specific social strata, the bureaucracy in a worker state. Three, its principal basis and center, the Soviet Union. Or rather, the Soviet Union is its principal location and center, because it was the first to suffer a political degeneration and is the most powerful of all the workers' state. It was from there that Stalinism spread like a virus through the communist movement and the world working class. Four, Stalinism is not the continuation, but the opposite and the mortal enemy of Marxism, Leninism, and Trotskyism. And that is why Trotskyism has been so hounded by the Stalinist movement, to the extent where every single adherent of our movement was exterminated by Stalin in the 1930s. That is, everyone he could get his hands on. Stalinism is a conservative, totalitarian, nationalistic, bureaucratic expression of privileged upper layers in a post-capitalist society, whereas Marxism is revolutionary, democratic, internationalistic, and representative of the interests and welfare of the working masses. Now, in regard to the phenomenon of Stalinism arising from the bureaucratic degeneration of the Soviet Union, it is, of course, necessary to explain it. But even more than that, and after that, after you explain it and understand it, since Marxism is a guide to action in the everyday struggles of the movement, it is necessary to combat it, to expose it, because the influence of Stalinism, its pernicious radiation, is not at all a matter of history and by no means a purely academic consideration. It didn't die with its originator, Stalin. It has survived, although modified, through his successors. And unless you have a comprehension of its causes, its characteristics, its consequences, you will not be able to understand the course and the conduct of world politics in our time. You will not be able to offer the right kind of leadership to radicalize students or workers or anyone else seeking a way out of capitalist society. Now, Stalinism is, of course, an international phenomenon, but it exists here in the United States, although it is now very much on the wane. You cannot, for example, understand what happened to the trade union movement in the 1930s, why it didn't pass over from adherence to the Democratic Party to a Labor Party, unless you understand what the intervention of the Communist Party at a critical turning point in the evolution of the CIO in combination with John L. Lewis meant. You can read all about it in the very minute detail in Art Price's book, Labor's Giant Step. And if you want to understand why the Detroit unions got the way they did, you will never be able to find out unless you plumb to the very depths the phenomenon of Stalinism through the instrumentality of the American Communist Party. Or you will not be able to understand what motivated the American Communist Party in supporting Johnson in 1964 as the lesser evil against Goldwater, as they had previously supported Franklin Delano Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy. I read a couple of weeks ago in a book which I recommend called As We Saw It in the 1930s. It's a collection of lectures given by prominent participants in the struggles of the 1930s, among them Norman Thomas, A.J. Musty, Max Shackman, Al Draper, and Earl Browder. And there I got proof. Shackman's article is a pretty good article, by the way, quite an honest one. And Browder's is honest, according to his life. So there, we are indebted to him for verifying what we knew at the time about the 1936 presidential election when the Communist Party first supported Roosevelt. He said that three delegates, with himself at the head, went to the 7th Congress of the Communist International in Moscow. And their Dimitrov, the secretary, told them that they had to support Roosevelt in 1936 because they had to form a popular front for collective security against the advance of fascism. And Foster, he's supposed to be the left communist, and the other delegate immediately agreed. But Browder resisted. Now you'd say, well, gee, that's pretty good. Until you hear his reasoning. He said, no, it will harm Roosevelt. if the Communist Party comes out openly and endorses Roosevelt, the right wing will make too much of it. He'll lose too many votes. It will mean the kiss of death. He says, we can do the same thing, he said, by running a token campaign and putting all the emphasis on the dangers of the Republican candidate. And he said proudly, you know, that's what we did. They accepted my advice, and as a result, Roosevelt got more votes than he would have got under the original proposal, and he came back into office with only two states against him. And Browder, you know, he expects to be patted on the back by history for having done that. Well, this is Simon pure Stalinism in both respects. First, the opportunism. The reliance upon presumably liberal representatives of the Catholic Church too, because now they have an outstretched hand to the Catholic hierarchy. They're a capitalist class on the one side, and their duplicity on the other. A duplicity which is shared by every practitioner of the Stalin school, from Browder to Mao Zedong. The great merit of the Trotskyist movement is not only that it stuck to the methods of class struggle in defense of working class interests consistently, but that it tells the truth to the workers, no matter how bitter that truth may happen to be at a given moment. And we have nothing to apologize for. Anybody can go back and read what we said 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 and 10 years ago. But if you go back and read what the Communist Party said, you'll not only find that they told lies, but that they told opposite lies every 5 years or so, and sometimes every other year or so. And this is the pestilence of Stalinism. Well, tomorrow I will go on to deal with the decline of this political phenomenon.
Okay, now we will have time for questions and answers and discussion.
Where can I get my hands on the submission of Roberts?
It's in that book, The 30s as we saw it, published by the University of Illinois Press. It just came out. No, not yet. It's a hard cover. I'm sure the Wayne Bookstore has it. Churchill government, I'm sorry. And Churchill was, I think, Chancellor of the Exchequer or something like that. Yeah. Yes.
What rationale did Stalin give to support his thwarting of the World Revolution?
The rationale was that it was necessary to give support to those forces in power or about who are in a position to administer the different capitalist regimes, who would be inclined not to make war upon the Soviet Union. In that way, the more militaristic, reactionary, counter-revolutionary elements in the capitalist classes would be quarantined and hamstrung. That was the major reasoning given, both in public and in private. And of course it was always said, this is just a temporary arrangement. We don't take it too seriously, but it's necessary for practical purposes. And naturally, those workers who were concerned about safeguarding the Soviet Union and putting implicit and total trust in Stalin and his spokesman went along with it. And as a result of that, many of them became bitterly disillusioned. That remains their chief rationale to this very day, in fact. And if you think that the be-all and end-all of revolutionary strategy is to act as border guards for the Soviet Union, no matter what happens to the movement elsewhere, which is considered expendable, while you're building socialism and then communism in Russia, then the whole thing flows logically from that basic premise. It seems incredible that he should be able to make this palatable to revolutionary movements in the rest of the world. But you have to go into specific problems which were paramount. In the 1930s, there was the 1920s, there was the fear of intervention from England, France, etc. In the 1930s, it was the spread of fascism. And it said it's also necessary not only to ward off war and invasion, but to defend bourgeois democracy against the fascists. In the 1940s, it was a necessity during the Second World War to subordinate everything to the defeat of Hitlerism, and so forth and so on. Now, of course, it's the H-bomb. Good.
If you read Georgia, you get the idea that, or you get the feeling that Thomas said that Trotsky, maybe during a very crucial period during the initial rise of Stalinism, that Trotsky did a little bit too much in reading the French novels and abstracted himself away from the real struggle that should have been carried on during that period. And, messing around with the railroads and so on. But could you put Deutscher in a little bit of perspective with us and try to give us an idea of what really went on in Trotsky's mind? Was it the objective conditions were just so overbearing for him that he really didn't want to initiate the struggle there? What exactly was it during that initial?
Retrospectively, it is much easier to say that this or that move might or could or should have been taken to ward off this or that development in a prolonged and life and death struggle. As those of you who have been engaged in any kind of a developing, fast-moving situation, you know it's not always simple to anticipate everything and all the complexities attending. Now, Trotsky has documented the positions he took, the reasons for them, and even his reflections upon them at every point along the way. He was, as you know, perhaps the most voluminous of all writers in the revolutionary movement. So there's no lack of documentation. It comes down, you know, to interpretation and weighing up the whole business. Max Eastman, for example, pivoted the downfall of Trotsky upon the fact that he didn't come to Lenin's funeral. And that meant that he was preparing his own funeral, politically speaking. Well, this is, you know, the trivial interpretation of history. Nothing in common with reality or Marxism at all. The oppositionists were confronted with extremely difficult, delicate, and complex tactical problems all the way along the line. But just look at the situation. They were responsible for the first workers' state. They were in the leadership position. They didn't know how far their opponents were ready or willing to go in the path they would take. They had to keep pulling them back. They were successful, as a matter of fact, in preventing the backsliding from going as far as its logic denoted. They had to organize an opposition under the most adverse conditions. And I think you can understand the problems involved. If you look back over the problems that confronted a revolutionary or militant worker in the auto union over the past 20 years, and you come now in 1967 and you say to a would-be, or once was, leader of the militants, well, here you are, you're without any influence, you're isolated, you might even have been expelled from the Union. If you were only a little bit smarter back in 1947 when Walter Reuther took over, you'd only done this or that, maybe all this could have been prevented. Now, does anyone who knows the realities of the trade union movement in the UAW over the past 20 years in Michigan say that the smartest people in this country could have outmaneuvered Walter Reuther and taken over the UAW? Well, there were people much smarter than Reuther. So we had a man named Bert Cochran, we had a man, Frank Lovell, we had an Art Price, we had a Cannon, we had a Dobbs, and any one of them, and even one half of them, could take Walter Reuther into account. It was just a matter of personal prowess and foresight and insight. But you can be the brightest and most capable leader in the world, but when all the fundamental forces are against you, you're going to find yourself high and dry, willy-nilly. You'll do the very best you can, but that's not enough. As a matter of fact, I was going to talk on this very question here at the forum this Friday on the theme frequently hurled at us by our critics. If you Trotskyists are so smart, why aren't you rich? That is, why don't you have more influence in the country, in the unions, and so forth, than you do have? I wanted to give a very broad and specific answer to that question. There are some people who say, and I did say to Trotsky, well, you were head of the Red Army, why didn't you take power with the Red Army? Well, Trotsky rejected that. He said, had I done so, the Soviet Union would have arrived at the same end under the different conditions, only by a different path, that's all. Because our movement, the Marxist movement, Bolshevism, Trotskyism, bases itself upon the conscious action of the masses of organized workers. And we do not propose to take power by any means without them or behind them or with the aid of any elite, armed or otherwise. And this course was, as I said, deliberately rejected by Trotsky, who went back to the ranks of the party and said, there we will start all over again to re-educate, reorganize the revolutionary vanguard, and then when a big turn in the situation comes, we will rise up with it, as the Bolsheviks did in 1917. Yes.
You mentioned the influence that Stalinism has had in the history of the United States over the years, in terms of the outcome of certain things like the labor unions and the Cadillac debate, but also the failure of certain of the direction that Stalinism took. For example, was the attitude of not supporting the march on Washington during the period of the war on account of we must all unite behind the war effort and things like that. The results of these things are associated not only with Stalinism, but they're also because of the revolution in Russia was made in the name of communism and socialism, and Stalinism took that association. You have one of the consequences lasting to this day of socialism having a bad name because of Stalinism, and also partly explaining the answers to the question that you raised, which was asked by Archie Rich. And there is a pamphlet by Janet that has dealing with the question of socialism and democracy, which I think is probably a good pamphlet.
That's true. I don't have the time to give a catalog of the crimes of Stalinism, even in one country, including our own. In fact, at the forthcoming Third Socialist Scholars Conference in New York, I'm scheduled to give a panel on radical intellectuals during the 1930s, which deals with what the communist movement did to the radical intellectuals of my generation. And I hope that it will be published. It will throw some light through personal reminiscence on that particular aspect of the damage done by Stalin. Yes.
Something I wondered about wasn't quite positive. When you try to talk to CP, they just have a very secretive atmosphere or something. They have a very condescending look on you and everything when you try to talk to them. So, do they physically identify with Stalin, even though the Fergus and the Khrushchev and the Brezhnev proceed and so forth? Do they physically identify
the enemy? Well, there are differing attitudes. There are the unregenerate Stalinists, most of whom are now concentrated in the Maoist camp, who say that Stalin was the successor of Marx, Engels, and Lenin, and the greatest revolutionary figure of his time. And they continue to idolize. They're still practitioners of the cult of Stalin. And it's very difficult to reason with the practitioners of a cult of any kind. There are now what we would call what the Chinese would call the revisionists, but we believe that Stalin was the original revisionist, and the Khrushchevists and Kosyginists are simply the continuators of that, who go along with the present attitude of the Soviet leaders that Stalin is virtually an unperson who engaged in a lot of criminal actions as a paranoiac, and it were better to say as little as possible about him. Then there are those who have what is known as the 50-50 attitude toward Stalin. Some things he did were very good, and some other things he did were very bad. And you ask them, well, when you add it all up, which prevailed? And they say, well, it's really hard to say. And they don't want to be driven to make a choice. And then there are others, we would call them the more open-minded communists, who are willing to listen and even to discuss and argue with Trotskyists. And these are the people who are largely, I find, who have been largely influenced by reading Deutsch's works and his biography. And they say, yes, we are convinced by Deutsch's case that the Trotskyists were right, the Stalinists did a lot that was wrong, and Stalin was pretty bad. And we don't want to have anything more to do with that. But don't think that we've become a Trotskyist and are going to join the Fourth International and adhere to the Socialist Workers' Party. Because after all, Stalin was at the head of the Soviet Union. And when did you ever lead a revolution? And when you tell them, well, you're celebrating one this year, they can't adjust to the fact that, and you tell them, but Trotsky was the man who led the revolutionary forces to power in October 1917. Well, this is so contrary to what has been inbred into their mind. They find it very difficult to adjust that this was a Trotskyist revolution.